Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of a bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. We're going to World War II today, and surprisingly, maybe, I have Nina with me. Hello, Nina.
Well, hi there, Alex. Yes, normally I don't get to do the World War II stuff. So this
Well, pointed part of World War II we're doing. I'm pretty sure you had to consult a map, right?
I did indeed. Although I must say, I did have half a clue as opposed to a full clue as to the location of the place we are talking about today. So without any further ado, I'd like to introduce our guest, Nick Le Huré, who is a historian who specializes in the Channel Islands during the Second World War. And so today, Nick is going to talk to us about British plans to try to either reoccupy the islands or to actually raid them during the Second World War. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you both. I'm really pleased to be here today talking to you about this.
This could be really cool. And you are currently on Guernsey. And if you go quiet, it's because you've been blown off the top of a cliff, right?
Yeah, we've got force 10 predicted for any time about now. So hopefully it'll be all right.
In your face specifically, direction-wise
yeah,
as well.
Pretty much, yeah. Direction-wise, it's coming from the northeast, which is basically straight towards my house.
Yeah.
But, okay. And I'm at the top of a hill, but there we go.
Yeah, some life choices there maybe being reconsidered. Let's try and keep you preoccupied so that you don't sit there panicking. First of all, let's talk about when and how the Channel Islands fall to the Germans during World War II. For those that don't know, they are British, but they're off the coast of France and they're closer to France, which might give you a clue as to how the Germans got hold of them.
Yeah, indeed. We're not part of the UK. We're British Crown dependencies. It's all really complicated to explain. But
you just get a slightly different passport, don't you? But you've got a slightly weirder postcode, but British dialing codes and Yeah,
and hence the slightly odd surname, which Nina did a fantastic job of pronouncing. It often gets butchered, as we mentioned earlier on when we were talking. So, as you said, we're just off the coast of France. Depending on which island you're on, Alderney is about 8 miles from the Cherbourg Peninsula. We're about 30 miles away from the closest point on the French coast. About 80 miles from the nearest point on the UK. Jersey is a bit further south from us, and they're also a little bit closer to the French coast than we are. So what happened was probably a little bit before we got occupied is probably worth talking about. So the British government were trying to decide what to do about Channel Islands as the Germans were coming across France, working their way across to the Cherbourg Peninsula. And it's quite interesting. I've read the War Cabinet minutes, and in the run-up to us eventually being occupied, they changed their mind so many times about what they were going to do. They sometimes changed their minds three times in one day as to what they were going to do. One minute they're going to send a brigade to come and defend the islands. Next minute, well, maybe we won't send a brigade, we'll send a slightly smaller force. Then they were thinking, well, maybe the Germans won't even bother, to be honest, because as far back as 1925, the islands had been assessed by the British government as not being of strategic importance either to them or any enemy. Interestingly, at the time, they they considered the French as being a possible enemy in 1925. Interesting concept.
Just like kind of wishful thinking with the whole maybe the Germans will just leave them alone, because there's kind of like a moral responsibility, isn't there? And yet nobody wants to tie up an entire brigade.
Yeah, exactly. And Churchill was quite keen that they did all they could to hold on to the islands, but was persuaded eventually that it was pointless, that the Germans may not come, but you know, there'd be such big loss of life if the islands were defended, that you know it wouldn't be worthwhile doing it. So on the 19th of June, they actually made the decision to declare the islands demilitarized. So all the British troops that were here, because there were quite a few British troops here, but mostly sort of training. There was a coastal command force at the airport here in Guernsey. We'd had quite a few troops come through from France from having not been able to get off the beach at Dunkirk. They'd come through the Channel Islands to make their way to the UK. But bizarrely, even at that point, people were still coming here on holiday. I've got adverts from UK newspapers, even in June, saying, you know, you need a rest from the war, go to the Channel Islands. Some people actually ended up getting stuck here when the Germans arrived. So one particular couple, which I've researched, came here planning on staying for a week, and that turned into 5 years. So
I kind of feel like they're even more culpable for life choices than you on the top of your hill right now.
Yeah,
a force 10 gale.
Indeed. So what happened after they decided they were going to demilitarize the islands? They didn't actually want to tell anybody yet, which was somewhat unfortunate. What they did offer, though, was they offered to evacuate islanders from all of the islands. And it went slightly differently depending on which island you were on. So Alderney, which is quite a small island, absolutely everybody left, bar about, it varies, around 20 people. The estimates vary on that, but they just basically all left in one go. But Guernsey, about half the population went, so about 20 odd thousand, or thereabouts. In Jersey, far fewer people decided to go. So there were only probably about 6,000-7,000 that left Jersey, and they had a much larger population than us.
Do you think that the British government had any other choice at this point?
No, not
even
really.
In the wider context of the war, we're going towards the Battle of Britain, aren't we?
Yeah.
You evacuated Dunkirk, you've been whooped on the continent.
Yeah. And the problem is, because we're, as I say, Guernsey is 80 miles south of the UK. Jersey, you're looking at just over 100 miles south of the UK. If you wanted to put up any aircraft to defend the islands, then they were going to have about 15 minutes time over the islands before they had to go back to refuel, whereas the Germans on the French coast were, you know, 20 minutes away in their aircraft, and they could be over the islands for a lot longer time. So it was interesting because people couldn't make their mind up whether to go or not, and people were, you know, some islanders were putting up signs saying don't go, don't be yellow, this sort of thing. Most of the men of military age were long gone anyway, because they'd gone off and joined up, the British forces in any case. So it was mostly women and children that left at that point, as I say, because most of the military age men had already gone. And then there was about a week after that. From about the 21st of June to the 29th of June, when pretty much it was pretty quiet. All of the accounts I've read here are saying, you know, they saw the odd German plane, but not really much happened, and they didn't know whether the Germans were going to come or not. Life seemed relatively normal. And then, unfortunately, on the 28th of June, still no announcement had been made that the islands were demilitarized, and St. Peter Port Harbour here in Guernsey was bombed quite heavily by the Germans. They mistook Guernsey tomato trucks that were queued up on the docks for being something to do with the army. They weren't. They were just exporting tomatoes. Unfortunately, a lot of the people that were down there crawled under their trucks when the bombing and machine gunning started. And then, of course, those trucks caught fire or were hit by bombs. So 36 people were killed in Guernsey. Jersey didn't get hit quite as bad. Nine people died in Jersey. One Guernseyman was killed on the lifeboat. He was coming back from Jersey, having the lifeboat having been over there. So at that point, everyone knew the Germans were definitely going to come at that point. It was just a case of when. So on the 30th of June, three Dornier DO-17s came over from France to do a bit of a recce and see what was going on. One of them decided he was going to land at the airport to see what, you know, what was happening at the airport. It looked pretty deserted. He landed, was there for about half an hour, had a bit of a look around, nobody about, was interrupted by three Blenheims, which came along and started machine gunning his aircraft. So promptly did a runner and cleared off back to France. Now, if you believe the German propaganda at the time, they had a massive dogfight with these Blenheims and shot them down, which is absolute rubbish. None of them were shot down. They just promptly legged it back to Cherbourg.
But is there time for... Oh, sorry, I was going to say. No, is there time for any of the civilians to get out, or have they missed their chance now?
No, they've missed their chance by that point, apart from a few people who escaped in the first couple of days of the occupation. There were quite a few that decided they were going to go on private boats and disappeared off the island then before it was too difficult to get away. Not that that wasn't in itself very risky, because German aircraft could have attacked them, German boats could have attacked them. But there were about 70 odd that got away in the first few days of occupation. On the 30th of June, the Germans decided they'd been preparing to invade by sea, but they decided that as nothing seemed to be happening, and the British government had finally announced that the islands were demilitarized, they just turned up at the airport here on the 30th of June in Guernsey and occupied the island. They then went on to occupy Jersey the following day, having dropped leaflets there saying that you had to fly white flags. So people had to improvise. So it was bed sheets and all sorts of things like that to show that they were surrendering in Jersey as well. And that's kind of how the islands fell on the 30th of June, 1940, and 1st of July.
I've got two questions, hopefully quick ones. The first one is regarding the people who left, especially early on. Where did they go in England? I mean, were there accommodation provided? Did they have to just shift as best they could?
They went to South Coast towns, and provision was made for them for accommodation. One of the rumours that stopped some people from going was, and there were a lot of rumours going around when the evacuation was starting. One of the rumours was that people were having to sleep in parks, and that's why, you know, people said, "Oh, I'm not going because that's going to," which was completely untrue. And how that rumour started, nobody knows. But they were looked after. School children who'd travelled with the teachers, etc., they were mostly shipped up to the north of England.
Right.
If they didn't have their parents with them or any relatives in the UK, then they were sort of long term fostered by people in England. So, people were found accommodation, and you know, like my grandmother, you know, went to do war work. She went and worked in a factory. A lot of people ended up in Yorkshire, actually. So, strangely enough, Guernsey has a lot of affiliation with the north of England, and the, you know, some people chose to stay there after the war. Have my grandmother having been there, my father having been born there, you know, we had a lot of they had a lot of friends and relatives there. So, you know, we used to go on holiday there in the 70s and 80s, you know, just to go back to where they used to live and things like that, go and see people.
That's a really interesting connection as a result of people, you know, being displaced
and ending up
in Yorkshire. The other question is, how many troops actually occupied? Do you know how many troops actually occupied Guernsey and Jersey?
Yeah, it was Initially, it wasn't very many. I think it was about 300 in Guernsey initially, which became about 600 by the time you got to later on in July. But they were flying everything in. They were just sort of finding their feet at that point. Later on in the war, it was a lot more. You were talking, about roughly about 30,000 across all of the islands. In Guernsey, at one point, there was one German for about every three people.
Now that's a significant occupation force, given the population and the supposed. This isn't a strategic location, at least on the part of the British government. That is interesting.
Speaking of, Grandad Churchill is clearly pissed off, isn't he? He wants the islands back.
Yeah, he does. He was mightily miffed, to say the least. He hadn't wanted to give them up at all in the foot, but was persuaded otherwise by, the chiefs of staff. He just came up with the multitude of reasons why it was a really bad idea. Not least, the Germans would have just bombed the living daylights out of the islands, and the civilian population would have been decimated. Particularly as the islands are mostly made of granite, so there aren't really caves and things to go and hide in. It's not very easy to make shelters. Some people did build, Anderson shelters, things like that, but there really wasn't anywhere to hide from any sort of bombing and things like that.
Interesting. So Churchill is super unhappy at this point. The chiefs of staff are saying, sorry, sir, this is insane. You can't do this. Yeah. As you pointed out, the civilian population will be decimated. The amount of troops we'd have to commit, the distance in terms of what you were talking about earlier, which is the limitations of aircraft, meaning, if you're flying from Norfolk, Suffolk, wherever the closest bases might be, you're already running out of fuel, or you've got half a tanker, however much you have. Yeah. It is strategically a serious problem to try to retake the islands. So how did the population react? How did folks who are not immediately in the top of staff react? I mean, obviously there are plans to retake the islands. So tell us about how some of the earlier ones. How does that begin, given all of the challenges?
So one thing that happened was and it shows how annoyed Churchill was about the fact that the islands had been taken. On the 4th of July, so literally just days after they'd been taken, a Guernseyman who was in the British Army, Hubert Nicol, was called in on the 4th of July and asked to come back to Guernsey to come and find out what was going on. So he was actually landed on the 8th of July. And because there weren't that many Germans around, they hadn't got organised in terms of preventing people from moving around that much. He was able to move around fairly freely for a couple of days. Handily, his parents' neighbours worked for the main company that supplied food to the island and was able to tell him exactly how many Germans were here from what the Germans were making them supply them. So he was then able to go back with that information. But that shows how annoyed Churchill was. And he subsequently ordered another raid, which was called Ambassador, which was a commando raid, which was 140 men, which took place on the 13th of July, not very successfully, turned into a bit of, in Churchill's words, a fiasco. He was not a very happy man. And said, well, that's it. We're not doing that again. But then they came back again in September with two more commandos to come and try and find out what was going on. The main driver for the planned large scale raids, or where they were looking at retaking some of the islands, was really driven by Mountbatten. he was really keen on the idea, and because he spent a lot of time with Churchill at weekends, he'd go and spend time with him there. he'd have the ear of Churchill while they were having dinner and things like, and he knew that Churchill was desperate to get, you know, some of the islands back. So they came up with a variety of plans over the years, which we can talk about those.
So what's the first large scale plan?
Yeah,
so the formulated to try to take back the islands then.
Yeah, so the first one that they had was in between February and March 1941. They had a plan which they called Operation Attaboy. And this was the first of the large scale plans. Initially they planned to retake one or all of the islands, which is a bit of a fairly broad approach to take. And then eventually they settled on Alderney, which is a small island, about 3 miles long, 1.5 miles wide. It's actually the closest to England. So, you know, it's only about 50 miles off the English coast. So easier for them to get to. Also, as I mentioned earlier, most of the civilian population on Alderney had left. So they weren't worried about the fact that they were going to be bombing their own civilians effectively. But they, interestingly, at that time, they had absolutely no idea about what the size of the garrison was, or what, you know, what weapons they had, or anything. But they were still determined that that was the way to go. They were going to.
It's like, what could possibly go wrong at this point?
Exactly. I mean, you know, going up an island which is predominantly cliffy, with only one beach that you'd really. Is wide enough that you could use it for a significant landing. You know, what could possibly go wrong? and it came out of Mountbatten and Churchill deciding that the time had come for them to take some offensive action with a view to forcing the Germans to fight and inflicting military losses on them, which again is interesting when you don't know how many there are on the island that you're going to retake. Now, they concluded it was probably feasible, but it would be high maintenance because, okay, you go and retake it. It's 8 miles from the French coast. The Germans can, you know, come and attack you at will, and you're still operating a relatively long supply line, which is going to be problematic. So after full discussions, they decided that, you know, they would recommend to the Prime Minister that Operation Attaboy should just not be attempted. So that one was put to bed fairly quickly. They started talking about it at the beginning of February, and on the 11th of March 1941, they decided not going to happen. Churchill wasn't very happy, but eventually they persuaded him. Again, it was for things like the RAF said, we haven't got the aircraft to spare. We need all the aircraft we've got. They were just worried about losses.
So this is like, at what point are they just sitting there going, who's going to go and tell him today that no one cares about the Channel Islands?
Yeah, if you read the minutes, it's quite interesting. Obviously, you don't know what discussions went on around what's written down in the minutes, but it's clear that everyone apart from Churchill and Mountbatten thought this was a really stupid idea.
Is it not equally as stupid just to plan an operation because Stalin asked you to?
Well, yeah, that's another one.
Oh, tell us about that one.
Yeah, that's the next one. So we get to March 1942. Now, you'll notice we're back in March again. The reason for that is really because they need to look at the where they've got enough, because they start planning in March, but they need enough daylight hours and the tides to be right and things like that. So this one goes quite a long way in the planning. It runs from March to May 1942. But it comes out of, unbelievably, Stalin was demanding a second front. And to appease him, they thought, well, let's have a crack at the Channel Islands. I'm not sure Stalin would have really cared about the Channel Islands very much, to be honest, or even been able to point them out on a map. It was an interesting
Stalin did, but he did fly Tamerlane's dead mummified body up and down the Eastern Front to see if the curse was real, though, didn't he? So I don't think he's necessarily always thinking that hard about the stuff that comes out of his mouth.
Indeed. But they thought it would appease him. So they came up with a plan, which was initially to hold Alderney permanently. They were going to use 6,000 to 7,000 men, 4,800 men to land. It was going to be a brigade of guards. And they actually got as far as training for the attack using the Isle of Wight, as they felt that parts of the Isle of Wight were sort of vaguely similar to Alderney, and they could do a bit of training there. One of the things I found in the archives is actually a great interview with a chap who is called Michael Hancock, who went on to be a general. And he talks a lot about what they were planning to do, how they were going to attack. He doesn't actually say anything about whether he thought it was a good idea. The interview was recorded much later after the war, a few decades after the war. But it's quite an interesting take on what they were going to do. And it shows how far they got. They'd worked out what ships they were going to use. They were going to have to use quite a few. And they were going to have a monitor to bombard the islands. It was going to be a fairly large scale thing. And they were going to bomb the living daylights out of Alderney before they even started, which obviously was going to tell the Germans that you were on the way anyway. So quite where they would have gone with that. It was an interesting one. But they scaled it back and decided they were going to hold it for a week, which I really don't understand why they were going to do that. If you're going to go to all that effort, potentially lose a lot of troops, why would you do it just for a week? That's certainly not going to appease Stalin. If you turn around and go, well, we did start a second front, but, we gave up after a week. They renamed the operation Aimwell when they scaled it back to being just a week. And it's quite interesting. I don't know if you've ever read any of Sir Alan Brooke's diary. His diary can be really, really dull at times, talking about birds that he's seen in the garden and where he's been for dinner and things like that. It's not particularly interesting, but there are some gems in there, one of which he notes in his diary on the 6th of May 1942 that he arrived just in time to the Chiefs of Staff meeting to turn down a proposed attack on Alderney in the Channel Islands as a large raid by the Guards Brigade. And he really didn't like Mountbatten. He just thought, Mountbatten was stirring all these plans up with the aid of Churchill. And they again talked about the whole reason why it was a bad idea. It was, again, down to committing aircraft. The RAF said, we haven't got enough. Alan Brooke actually said in the meeting that he doubted that even if they dropped the amount of bombs on the islands, they were talking about using 500 or 600 aircraft.
Wow. But,
yeah, absolutely. It's an incredible amount of, and they were going to bomb the islands for 2 days before they bombed Alderney for 2 days before they attacked it. But Alan Brooke pointed out it's mostly made of granite. You're not going to do a lot of damage. It seems a little bit pointless. The RAF weren't keen, and the Navy weren't overly keen either, to be fair. So that operation got canned.
Do you, at that point, had they actually got some legitimate intelligence as to the number of German troops on Alderney, or were they just...
No.
Yeah, they were winging it, so to speak.
They were very much winging it as to what was going on in Alderney. They really didn't know, what was going on. I mean, the Germans had started building, proper fortifications by that point. If they tried in 1941, they weren't that well fortified, so they might have had a bit of a chance. But still, it would have been, pretty dicey.
Gosh, that is fascinating. That despite having no real numbers, no real reconnaissance, that the drive to retake is so strong. And I understand that they were trying to appease Stalin, so Stalin wouldn't back off from the Eastern Front and say, nope, taking my troops back, you know, sorry, you guys are on your own. So I certainly recognize that. But it's fascinating to me that they would develop an operation of that size, commit that many aircraft at a time when, you know, aircraft were still, if you lost one, it was still a really big deal, not to mention losing pilots.
Yeah.
That somehow this almost from the start futile gesture is something that they commit a huge amount of time and energy to.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
Yeah, it's knowledge we've got today. Yeah, it's incredible that they even contemplated it.
Definitely, yeah, that is fascinating. So they withdraw this one as well, particularly even after downscaling it, so that it's going to be a week, you know, with the recognition that, well, if you're going to do that and then you're going to withdraw, what purpose are you actually serving? What is happening by 1943? Are there additional plans? I mean, at this point, it's pretty clear to everybody involved that this war is not ending anytime soon, and there are multiple fronts. And so citizens, you know, of Guernsey and Jersey are still occupied, as you pointed out earlier. The longer this goes on, the more troops the Germans have in order to make sure that nothing, you know, there's no funny stuff on the part of the population. So by the time we get to 1943, what's the state? Is Churchill still pushing to take back? Has he given up? Has his attention focused elsewhere? What's happening in the Channel Islands during this period?
Yeah, sure. It was still bubbling on, and Mountbatten really went for it this time. They planned another operation called Operation Constellation. And Mountbatten upped the ante in January 1943 at the Joint Chiefs of Staff meeting in Casablanca, where he made the very bold statement that he would capture the Channel Islands without any help from the United States. Now, this had come about because it was all about landing craft, and the United States representatives basically said, no, you can't have any landing craft because we need them for operations that we're going to be running. So, no, you can't have them. And he basically threw his toys out of the pram, and it's minuted that he actually said, you know, I'll recapture the Channel Islands without your help, which is a very bold statement to make, particularly in that particular forum. So anyway, he continued with his idea that this should happen. Initial plan to take back one or more of the Channel Islands. This all sounds very familiar, doesn't it? And again, we're talking February, March, this time in 1943. This time he also went for it because he wasn't really sort of settling for Alderney originally. He decided that we're going to try and retake all of the islands. So Constellation, whilst it was the name of the overarching operation, had three sub-operations, which were Condor, Coverlet, and Constantina. And they planned this in really great detail. There were a huge amount of work that went into it. It was astounding. So Condor assumed that they were going to take Jersey, which is the largest island in the Channel Islands, but also the furthest away from the UK. Coverlet, they were going to take Guernsey. concertina, they would take good old Alderney. Now, it would have been devastating if they eventually went on to pick Alderney yet again. But it would have been devastating for the civilian population if they'd tried to do this, you know, if they picked just one of the other islands, let alone, you know, decided to try and take all of them. I mean, that would have just been absolutely awful. They were talking about dropping 1,500 tons of bombs, which, you know, Guernsey's 25 square miles, Jersey's 45 square miles. That's a lot of bombs to be dropping. They were, again, talking about 500-600 aircraft. They were trying to get the US Air Force involved this time using B-17s as well as the RAF bombing. So that would have been, you know, disastrous. But having thought about it, you know, they were going to, if they tried to take Guernsey, they looked at various different combinations of how they could do it. Now, one of their big problems was that Guernsey had an enormous gun battery on it called Myris, which had a range. It could fire just over 30 miles. So it could cause big problems because it could you know, reach most of the water around Alderney and also down towards Jersey, covering Sark and Herm as well. So that would have been a big problem. But they looked at that and thought, well, maybe we need to retake Guernsey first before we try and do anything else. So they planned an attack on St. Peterport, the main town, which is also the main harbour. And they were going to land on a beach, which is just to the north of there, Belgrave. But they're also going to land further round the island in Grand Havre and also on the south coast. And then they're going to work their way across the island. And again, this would have been really nasty fighting. There were a huge amount of fortifications. Over the entire war, the Germans put 10% of the concrete from the Atlantic Wall. So that's 10% of the total that ran all the way from Norway all the way down to Spain, went into the Channel Islands. So that's a lot of fortifications, which you can still see around the island, around the islands today. So they looked at that. They then thought, well, if we take Guernsey, we can go on and take Jersey. This gets even more strange because Mountbatten actually says in one of the meetings, and it's in the minutes, I envisage a raid something like Dieppe. Now, we all know how Dieppe turned out. they were going to land on two sides of Jersey and basically fight their way across the islands, the island of Jersey, using tanks. And that was just going to be a massive bombing campaign. Bearing in mind, there were a lot of people still in Jersey. Most of the population was still there. That would have been absolutely disastrous. So they thought about it a bit more and then said, what about Alderney? Very strange thing to think. In March 43, they decided, yeah, let's try Alderney. Minimal civilian population, same old story as before. They knew by this point that there were slave workers there, probably about 500 of them. But that's probably quite light, actually. They probably got that number wrong. But I'm not even quite sure how they got the intelligence that was the case. It may have been from one of the commando raids that happened around that time that they found this out. Also, people were escaping from the Channel Islands, and albeit not very frequently because it wasn't very easy, but some people were escaping. They were interviewed by MI19 in the UK when they arrived, so they got a lot of valuable information from them. So I'm guessing that's kind of where they got the estimate of 500. But I'm not really sure that, you know, if they had any other intelligence that helped them. But the idea for doing this was they had one eye on the fact that they eventually were going to have to attack France to try and kick the Germans out. And they were worried about shelling the Allied forces when they're attacking the Cherbourg Peninsula, because they could easily have hit shipping there. So they thought about doing that again. Eventually, they aborted it due to the lack of landing craft, because although Mountbatten had said, I'm going to do it, I don't care if we've not got your landing craft, he did actually try and get some landing craft from other sources from the Royal Navy, where he was told to go away, more or less. They didn't actually tell him to go away, but they made it so difficult for him to actually obtain any landing craft that the number they were going to have were going to be minimal. So it was just really not worth it. And again, fairly similar objections. The RAF were a little bit more on board now because, we're in 1943. Things were had moved on in terms of aircraft production, etc., training of pilots. But they still weren't massively keen on the whole idea. The Royal Navy equally weren't particularly keen because they knew they were going to have to put up a force to attack France, but also they were busy in other places. So again, it was eventually rejected.
Fascinating that this keeps coming up and they keep revisiting it with variations, and yet at the same time, it strikes me, and correct me, this is your area of expertise, that they're not changing that much in terms of their approach, other than they're committing more troops, more planes, more bombs, and more ships. Did Mountbatten ever articulate his reasoning behind this in terms of, if we do this, what's the strategic advantage? Or was it still very much, we must do this, these are our people, these are our islands?
Yeah, there were a couple of reasons. He didn't particularly articulate them himself, but they were, I would say, he probably put words into Churchill's mouth by, you know, these times where he was staying, with him. So, you know, so he was saying, it's a matter of prestige. We should retake one of the islands, or, you know. And the other thing that he said was, you know, we want to get the Germans worried. They won't know what's happening if we start attacking the Channel Islands. What's coming next? Are we going to, you know, start landing on the mainland France in force? So that was partly it as well.
Interesting. So he keeps, so it's, well, Churchill is interested, it's Mountbatten who is arguing for this, who is basically saying, yes, we need to do this, and here's why.
Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting. Knowing, having read at different points that Mountbatten has a rather titanic ego, you have to wonder how much of this is strategic on his part as well. To further his own career. I mean, that's a very cynical take on it, but it does strike me that, you know, that with the information that they do have, with what they begin to hear and how they've been argued out of it several times before, that what he's formulating really isn't all that different from his previous, you know, from the previous plans that they had.
Yeah, so, it's really odd, isn't it? It's just that, that didn't work. Let's try the same thing again, or a variation on the same thing again. It's just a very odd way of thinking about it. Surely you'd try and reimagine it as something completely different.
It does strike me that if you are receiving arguments from the armed forces that are actually going to execute this operation, and they're telling you, you know, look, as you pointed out earlier, we don't have the planes, we don't have the fuel, we can't support an operation like this, you know, and then whatever the Navy is saying is, look, this is too many ships, you know, we'd have to stay there. There's enormous gun battery that can blow us all out of the water. And, you know, this is, it's not feasible. And by the way, if you want landing craft, you need to do these 600 forms and, you know, oh, sorry, you know, we need permission from this other person too. So I'm intrigued by the fact that this appears to become a personal crusade of Mountbatten's at this point, that, you know, he's not going to take no for an answer. Yeah. So by the time we get to the end of 1943 and we are, you know, heading for into 1944, they continue to formulate different approaches, don't they? Tell us about where they, you know, where do they go next? And also at the same time, how are the citizens of the Channel Islands doing with, you know, having been occupied for now, you know, several years? And as you pointed out earlier, you know, there are a lot of German troops. It's not, you know, 600 anymore. It's an enormous number. And as you said earlier, you know, it's really sort of like one for every three residents that are still on the islands. Sorry, that's too big. Feel free to approach him. Why don't you tell us, if you could tell us a little bit about what's happening on the islands in the meantime, to the citizens there, that would be.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, they were already suffering hardships in terms of getting food and things across from, even by that stage of the war. You know, the shops had very little left in them. If you were lucky, there was a lot of bartering going on. Rationing was very, very strict. It's pretty horrible. But interestingly, in the escapes from the Channel Islands, there's in some of the interviews, there are complaints made by these people that escaped when they're being interviewed by MI19. They're saying, you know, why didn't you come on the island? You know, there were some bombings, but there were a very small number of aircraft involved and almost what you'd probably call a surgical strike. Not that a surgical strike existed at that point, but they involved very few aircraft and they were targeted at specific military installations where there probably weren't going to be too many, you know, the RAF bombing the islands, and the people in the islands would have welcomed it because it would have given them some hope that something was actually being done and they hadn't been forgotten about. They also complained that there were no radio broadcasts to the Channel Islands. If they did broadcast to the Channel Islands specifically, then the Germans might think that, you know, something's going on. You know, there's going to be an attack and they might take measures against the community. So there was that. They also complained that they hadn't dropped newspapers on the islands, so you know they didn't know what was going on and all sorts of things like that. Now, interestingly, later on in the war, things like that did happen. They did drop newspapers on the islands to keep people up to date with going on, what was going on, and also to try and leaflets to try and encourage the Germans to surrender. But you know, most people were just being quite, I don't know how you'd put it really, just carrying on doing the best they could in the circumstances and just hoping for one day they would be liberated.
It does sound as if it would have been incredibly demoralizing because you're getting no news, because you have no idea what's going on, because the islands are occupied by fairly significant numbers of troops. And you are hearing nothing. So you have no communication. You have no information. You have no broadcasts. Situation on the islands is pretty grim, as you pointed out, in terms of, you know, the food you can get and so on. And so it's completely understandable that it must have felt to many people that they were forgotten. We don't matter, you know, and we don't even know what's happening. You know, I mean, is this it? Have the Germans won? So that certainly, was there any resistance on the part of the residents of the islands themselves just to try to, you know, to try to fight back, to try to make a statement, take a stand? I mean, clearly they were outnumbered by this point in the war. But I'm curious as to whether or not there were any efforts on the part, you know, was there a resistance movement or anything like that on the islands at that
point? Yeah, it's a difficult one. And I've looked at this quite a lot. It depends what you mean by resistance. You couldn't have resistance like you could on mainland Europe, where, you know, you could go and blow up some railway tracks and then run away 40 kilometers away and go and hide in a forest or halfway up a mountain or something like that. You were on a small island, you were stuck there, you know, they were going to catch you pretty quick. All weapons have been confiscated. There were no attempts by anyone to supply weapons to the islands, precisely because they just thought, you know, it's going to cause, you know, massive problems if it did. Right. However, there were radios had been confiscated. They were given back briefly and then they were confiscated again. But people built crystal radio sets so that they could get the news. There were two underground news sheets that were started, which One was called GUNS, Guernsey Underground News Service, and another one called GASP, which was Guernsey Active Secret Press. Now they took great risks in distributing these leaflets. Some people were trusted, so that they were basically, you know, delivered to their house. Others knew that if you went, for example, there was a large branch of Lloyds Bank in St. Peterport, and if you went in and asked the right question, you would be given one of the news sheets to look at hidden inside of a book. Also, that one of the libraries, people knew that it would be in a book. So there was that sort of activity that went on. There were also things like the V for Victory, because people had heard the broadcasts encouraging the French to do things like that by doing the chalking V's on things or painting V's on things. So people did that. The Germans tried to turn it into their own sign by putting laurel leaves around them and things like that. But there were things like that. People made pin badges with the king's head on, made out of English coins, and they'd wear them under their lapel. And if they saw somebody they trusted, you know, they'd just flash their badge. Again, that was, you know, a very dangerous thing to do. There was a lady actually who earned the nickname Mrs. Churchill, because she worked in the Royal Hotel, which was a big hotel that had been taken over by the Germans. And one of the chefs that worked there was Swiss. But every morning when she turned up to work, he used to shout Heil Hitler at her, because he knew it particularly annoyed her. So she said Heil Churchill, and she used to do that. She did that a few times, and then somebody dubbed her in. So she got sent to prison in France, where she then went on to make sew on a handkerchief, Heil Churchill, and various other things. But in sort of karma, the guy that actually the Swiss chef got caught stealing things and ended up getting shipped off to prison himself. So, but there were things like that, small acts of defiance or resistance. A lot of islanders were made to work for the Germans. You had no choice if you wanted to get food. You had no choice, or you'd be shipped off to prison somewhere in France or Germany. But what they did was either worked very slowly, or did a bad job. There was a German ship that was damaged near Sark, and there were a crew that were recruited to go and salvage it. And they managed to drag it out right until the end of the war. So for over 9 months without actually any success, because they just deliberately were not doing what they were supposed to. They made it out that it was far more difficult than the Germans thought. And, you know, things like that just caused problems.
So lots of everyday acts of resistance and rebellion to slow things down and also to keep up morale, given the situation that everyone was in, and that you could be shipped off to prison for, you know, anything that the occupying forces decided they felt like shipping you off for. That's really quite impressive, you know.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and as you said, because while you do get the occasional radio broadcast, it's dangerous to do it. Well, you do get little bits of news. So it's fascinating that you have a population that is determined to resist as much as they possibly can, given the circumstances, with the hope that, you know, if we make it tough here, at least it'll be harder for the Germans. At least we'll, you know, we may not wear them out, but we can certainly slow them down and drive them crazy. Take their attention on us, and, you know, prevent them from thinking it's easy just to be here. That's quite fascinating. So ultimately, how are the islands freed? Is there a successful commando operation? Is there a successful raid? Or do those things continue to be spoken about, but that's not ultimately what happens at the end of the war?
There were a lot of commando raids throughout the war,
right,
around the islands, of varying success. But again, they kind of petered out by the end of 43. There was one planned for early 44, which would have involved Anders Lassen, who's a very famous commando. But that was called off because of bad weather in the end. They were going to come in and either steal one of the boats or from the harbour or blow it up. So yeah. What happened in the end for the liberation was they basically, the Allies worked out that they basically had a massive prisoner of war camp, which didn't need any guards. They just left the Germans to it, more or less. Things got very tough for the local population. You know, food was very scarce. And then they just had to wait it out until the 9th of May 1945. So a flotilla came across, were told by the representative of the Germans that if they didn't withdraw further away, they would shell them. That was on the 8th of May, and they replied that the commandant would be hung in the morning if as a war criminal if he did shell one. So eventually they did surrender on the 9th of May in Guernsey, and then surrendered slightly later in Jersey on the 9th of May also. That was fortunately force wasn't required, but the British were prepared to use force if they had to. But again, it would have probably turned out very badly for all involved, both the British forces and the Germans, and certainly the civilian population.
Yeah, no, it sounds as if the fact that they were able to get the Germans to surrender at this point without having to shell everyone, you know, without having to actually start a battle, ends up being the smartest decision of all at that point. So we get to this point, and the citizens have been liberated. What happened to the people who had left? Did they return? Did they, you know, I would imagine that given the fact that the islands were occupied for such a long period of time, that, you know, the aftermath of this was challenging for everyone who'd remained and also for everyone who had left.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very difficult for everyone immediately afterwards. To be fair, the Allies brought in a lot of foodstuffs very quickly. We had the Red Cross had been delivering food since the end of December 44, okay. So that helped a little bit. But the Germans basically had made a bit of a mess of the place, particularly in Alderney, where they'd pretty much destroyed most of the buildings because they ripped out all the wood and used it for firewood, and it was a right mess. So it was sort of a different experience depending on which island you were coming back to. People were quite keen to return quickly, but you had to get a permit to come back because they wanted to control the island. Months that people came back to Guernsey and Jersey, it was a very different prospect because the place was in a mess. They didn't actually have their what they call their homecoming day until December 1945. There were a small group of people that went back, primarily government officials, to try and sort things out with the British forces. But the bulk of the population didn't return until much later. And then some decided that actually things were such a mess that they would go back to the UK from Alderney. But gradually people came back to the islands as and when they could get here.
Interesting. Quite challenging for all concerned, really, as the only, you know, the only portion of the Britain that had been occupied for that length of time, and you know, and really sort of cut off for so much of the war. It's really impressive. Nick, this has been wonderful. I mean, although I have of course done some reading, this is a side of World War II that I knew very little about, and so it's been terrific having you on, and I've been fascinated by the excellent stories that you've told. And all the detail you've been able to give us about what happens, what goes wrong, and really, you know, what is it like to be on the Channel Islands during World War II, which I imagine this is an aspect of the war that many people don't know about. So tell us, what are you doing next with this? Do you have a book underway or articles, or am I rumbling you and you weren't ready to, and if you're not ready to say anything, that's fine too, but I'm sure the listeners of History Hack are going to want to know what happens next.
Yeah, sure. Well, I've been running a website for a couple of years now, which has got various articles as I find things that I think will be of interest to
Fantastic.
People. It's great because new stuff comes out all the time, because a lot of the books were written 30, 40 years right. ago. Some stuff was still not available in the National Archives, not available in the archives now that is available. So I've been doing that. But yes, I have got a book contract, which was signed just before the end of December.
Congratulations. That's fantastic.
So I'm in the process of writing a book about escapes from the Channel Islands, because that's an area that nobody's really written about. There have been some short articles
right.
about it. There was one book about escapes from Jersey, but it was produced on a very small scale some years ago. I think it was a limited edition. There were about 700 copies.
Right. Okay.
But nobody's really written about it in detail. A lot more information has come out since. So I settled on that was what I was going to write about. I didn't want to, you know, regurgitate sure. the stuff that's happened, that, you know, that's in all the other books. So just by pure chance, I'd started writing the book, and on what's now called X, but what I still refer to as Twitter, I had somebody contact me from a publishing company. And we had a chat, a couple of Zoom calls and a lot of emails. And a contract was sent through, and I felt like they were the sort of guys I could work with. So, yeah, so I was pleased to get that signed up. So I'm now beavering away. Fortunately, I'd already done a lot of the research, so that helps a lot. And I'm beavering away on that at the moment. So I'm now running to a deadline for finishing the book, which is got to submit it by January next year. So. I've got a bit of time.
That's fantastic. Yeah, and so you know, we may well want to know more when the book actually comes out. But anyway, it's been wonderful having you on History Hack today. Thank you so much for giving us a big chunk of your time to talk about a fascinating subject that very few people really seem to understand and know about. It's been a great pleasure. I hope you've enjoyed yourself too.
I have. Yeah, it's been great. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to, you know, get this story out there. Because as you said earlier, not a lot of people know a lot of this stuff.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.